Okay, we are plugged in and ready to go. It's Tuesday the 13th of September 2016. You're listening to the Kraz Files podcast, and you can get this podcast over at iTunes and of course our website, which is krazfiles.com. Plenty of stuff going up there to have a look at, lots of podcasts and news links, videos going up each day, and also I would encourage people to comment, because there's a comments bar that scrolls around and people can highlight that and check your comments out. You're going to want to turn that into a blog. You can also come over to Facebook and check us under the Kraz Files. I'm doing very well over there, putting up a ton of stuff that sometimes doesn't go over to the actual website. So come over and like our page there. You can also like our new website, which is opensourcetruth.com. So Dr. Rima and Lawyer Ralph Fusitola working hard over there. A lot of those links also go up on the Natural Solutions Facebook page, and going on 110,000 likes there, so we put our stuff up there and goes very well. So like that, and Open Source Truth as well. And we're ready to rumble, and Anthony Peake is joining me for a little under an hour today. We'll do that, and for a chat about his new book. Anthony was with me around the same time last year, talking to Garth and I about his work, incredible research, and I follow Anthony's work all the time, and his Facebook posts and everything, and his new book coming out. We're going to go over that, but just before we spoke to Anthony last year, he was coming down to Melbourne, which was a big trip for him, going to talk about that as well, and to the Afterlife conference, and my friend Barry Eaton was speaking at that. And also one of the organizers of that conference heard our first talk with Anthony, and he loved it so much he put that up on the website there to promote the conference. So our last talk with Anthony is of course up on the website. It's called The Passenger, and that trended very well, and on Google searches and everything, it's still out there. So very good to hear, Anthony. It's good to chat with you tonight and today for you in the UK.
No, absolutely. It's wonderful again talking to you, Adam. I've been looking forward to this.
Yeah, it's great. Nearly got the times mixed up as well, Anthony, today. You're actually about 9 hours behind, so it is Tuesday around 11 a.m. or so for you. I'm so used to speaking to people in the US that, you know, we're a day ahead here, but you're actually the same day in the UK. Get my times right there. But how have you been, my friend?
Not so bad. It's been crazy busy with the new book coming out, and I'm doing a lot of promotional, both interviews and talks. I was speaking at a conference over the weekend, and I've got various other events coming up in the next month or so. Plus, as I said, the book launch. The anticipation for the new book is phenomenal. In fact, the new book, I don't know if you get the magazine down there. I guess you do, call 40 and Times?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, because it's massively popular over here in the UK within the alternate community, but they're also known for being quite quite tough on their markings for their books. And they've reviewed three of my books, and I've got 9 out of 10. And the new book has got the gold standard of a 10 out of 10 rating, which they very, very rarely do. So I'm absolutely really so pleased at that, because that's the gold standard. Fantastic review, though, which is in 14 Times this month. In fact, it's due out in the next couple of days. So very exciting times, I think. And at the present moment in time, I've got two book deals, and I have two books to deliver to two different publishers by this time next year. I'm writing a book on J.B. Priestley, the British dramatist and author. And I'm also, because this new book, Opening the Doors of Perception, has got such positive reviews and such a positive reaction, my publisher Watkins have already asked me to write a sequel to it, which will be coming out in 2018. So there's a book out for 2017 on J.B. Priestley and a book out on 2018 as well. So busy times.
It certainly is. I think when I first spoke to you, I was getting through your incredible book, Is There Life After Death? The Extraordinary Science of What Happens When We Die. It's really ahead of its time, that book. And also The Daemon, which I purchased. And I think our first talk was a lot about that, because it just struck me so deeply, that book. And I've been waiting for your book, for your new book, which is Opening the Doors of Perception, The Key to Cosmic Awareness. And the other day I was just on there looking at your books, because I get them on Kindle, and I was looking at The Immortal Mind, Science and the Continuity of Consciousness Beyond the Brain. And they give you a few free chapters, and I started reading it and I got hooked. So I had to get that as well. So I'm in a bit of deep water here because I just couldn't put it down. And that's a great book, and I would encourage people to grab The Immortal Mind, because it's kind of chopped up into about three sections. And there's all these great historical studies on near-death experiences and, you know, really real stuff, probably some of the most famous cases that you would get. And the book is so well written, and I think it's great for beginners and people who are just delving into this and who are interested in the subject as well. So I've got that to deal with. But and I'm a little bit, just sort of gasping for air today, I guess, in regards to your new book, because I don't have it yet. It's telling me in Australia it will be available on the 17th. So a few days for me to get. But that's why we're here today as well, to talk about opening the doors of perception. It sounds like you're going to get a wonderful reception to this book. Why don't you have the floor a little bit and tell us about writing this book, how it came about, and you know, the new research. Obviously, you're going into much deeper waters with this book. Tell us, we want people to obviously buy it as well. You know, we don't want to give too much away, but tell us a little bit about what people can expect with this new book, because I'm just very excited about getting into this. I really love your work, and I do mean that. It's you're the kind of guy who doesn't seem to stop. You don't sort of just resurface every few years with a book and a couple of interviews. You just keep plowing through every day, because I noticed that on your Facebook page as well. You just don't stop putting out information. So how's this experience been for you? And is this are all your books a labor of love? Are they or are they just sort of, you've just continuing? Was this a hard book to write, or how did it go for you?
Well, not at all, really. As you know from my earlier books, the book The Daemon and Is There Life After Death, I was taking a fairly precise position regarding altered states of consciousness and such like, arguing that they are brain generated, but the question arises as to what do we mean when we're talking about brain generated in the first place, because reality as we perceive it is effectively brain generated, in that the brain processes data, external stimuli, and recreates that in the brain to recreate an inner facsimile of what the external reality seems to be. And I was wanting to broaden that topic, and when Irvin Laszlo approached me to write The Immortal Mind with him, just as a bit of an aside there, Irvin Laszlo is world-famous researcher, and he's written books with people like Mikhail Gorbachev and the Dalai Lama and various other people. So when he approached me to write The Immortal Mind, I was staggered that somebody that famous and that influential wanted to write a book with me. And it was funny because Irvin turned around to me and said, "You're the only person I think I can write this book with, because of the way you are taking ideas into totally new areas." Because for me, my whole writing career has been based upon a simple premise. And that premise is that extraordinary claims need extraordinary proofs. There are many, many writers out there who, what they do is they regurgitate anecdotes. All you'll get, you'll read their books, and all it will be is, gee whiz, somebody had an out-of-the-body experience. Gee whiz, somebody had an NDE. Gee whiz, somebody had alien encounters. What I'm trying to do is to explain what's taking place, or at least suggest explanations or areas of research that we can follow in terms of these phenomena, because we will never ever convince those who are in denial of such experiences by just reiterating subjective experiences of people. We need strong proof to take to the not the critics necessarily, but materialist reductionists. And materialist reductionists are the individuals who except that our modern understanding of science is the correct one. Now, materialist reductionist science has given us a wonderful world model. You know, there's no question we would not be communicating now if it wasn't for the materialist reductionist worldview. However, it is self-evident that there are areas of human experience and there are areas of reality around us that cannot be explained purely and simply by applying our present scientific model to it. For instance, nobody is really any closer to understanding the hard problem of consciousness, which your famous Australian philosopher David Chalmers first brought to the world's attention back in the mid-1990s, when he quite rightly pointed out that we can probably solve the soft problem of consciousness, which is how the brain works. In other words, we can, by doing CAT scans and PET scans and various other things, draw a map of the brain and what the brain does under certain circumstances. So if somebody's feeling stress or anxiety or is experiencing a headache or anything else, we can see which part of the brain lights up. And we can therefore draw an ideal map of how the brain communicates. We also know what areas of the brain are responsible for what things. However, that is the easy problem, the soft problem of consciousness. The hard problem is how a collection of atoms, which in effect the brain is, and of course the atoms themselves are 99.9% empty space anyway, can come together and at some crucial point, an amalgamation of those atoms reacting with electrical forces can create Adam or create Anthony, can create our inner world, can create our hopes, our dreams, our anticipations, can create the sensation of the color red, can create the sensation of love, can create an appreciation of Mozart or an appreciation of Led Zeppelin. These things are inexplicable. And what I'm trying to do with my books, and particularly with the new book, is to try and give points of observation and applying known science to the consciousness riddle. Now, I call it opening the doors of perception because way back in 1954, there was an Englishman exiled in, well, he wasn't exiled, he chose to live in California, called Aldous Huxley, who was a fairly famous intellectual British writer. And Huxley had written a series of novels over the years that had given him quite a reputation as quite a deep thinker. But he became intrigued about the nature of consciousness within the brain. And he had heard of a series of experiments that had been done by another Englishman called Humphrey Osmond, who was based in a large institution in Saskatchewan in Canada. And Humphrey Osmond was as a psychiatrist, and he was working with people who had schizophrenia, experienced schizophrenia, and other radically altered states of consciousness. And he discovered quite curiously that by giving individuals who have schizophrenia hallucinogenic substances, it actually weakened the hallucinations, not made them stronger. And Osmond was fascinated by this, and he particularly used a substance called mescaline or peyote, which is derived from cacti. And it's a very, very strong hallucinogenic substance that was first discovered by the Native Americans in Arizona and the southern states of America. Now, this particular substance is powerful. And Aldous Huxley was wanting to expand his own understanding of reality, particularly because he was aware of the writings of a guy called C.D. Broad, who was a British philosopher, and also the writings of a gentleman called Henri Bergson, who was a French philosopher at the turn of the 19th into the 20th centuries. Now, Henri Bergson believed that the brain was an attenuator. The brain was a reducing valve. In other words, what we can perceive of reality, if the doors of perception were open, would be far, far wider. In other words, the brain takes information out and presents to us a watered down, diluted version of what external reality is really like, or what things that we can perceive, because external reality is the question as to whether external reality is out there or not. But Huxley was very keen to take this forward. Now, he had Humphrey Osmond bring down some peyote, some mescaline from Canada, from Saskatchewan down to California. And he took some of the substance. And he described his experiences in a book he wrote called The Doors of Perception. And The Doors of Perception was based upon a quote, a famous part of a poem by William Blake, who said, if the doors of perception were cleansed, we would see reality as it really is, infinite. But we are trapped within our cave. We are trapped within our perceptual worldview. And it stops us from really experiencing the true nature of reality. The book became profoundly popular. And in the counterculture in the 1960s, The Doors of Perception was, you know, the standard reading, together with the work of people like Carlos Castaneda and others, because what it did was it made people realize that reality was far broader. And of course, Jim Morrison named his band The Doors after The Doors of Perception. So for me, what I wanted to do was to take the work that Aldous Huxley had done in the 1950s and update it for what we now understand regarding the brain, regarding quantum physics, regarding neurophysics, regarding neurochemistry, and also regarding a lot of the research that has been done in the liminal areas of human consciousness, people like Michael Persinger up in Canada at the Laurentian University in Sudbury, and various other people who have been doing some fascinating experiments in terms of human perception. Now, in the years between Huxley's book and nowadays, we now have many, many books written on the near-death experience, the out-of-body experience, lucid dreaming, sleep paralysis, and many other areas. We also now have far more powerful hallucinogenic substances such as dimethyltryptamine, and its mixture, ayahuasca. So we're now in a position we can also scan the brain far more effectively than we could do in the 1950s. So we're in a position now that we can isolate what these substances do within the brain and how they bring about hallucinations. Now, my approach in the book is asking one huge question, and that question is, what exactly are hallucinations? In other words, you will always find that the pat explanation for an out-of-the-body experience, and indeed a near-death experience, is, oh, it's an hallucination. And that's where the inquiry seems to stop. You know, somebody comes along who is a all-knowing, all-powerful neurologist or psychologist or psychiatrist and gives that wonderful diagnosis. But the reality of the point is that they don't actually know what hallucinations are. We have the labels for them, and I call this the explanatory labeling theory. In other words, give something a label, and then you conveniently pretend to explain it, preferably if you can give it a nice Latin name, like paramnesia for explaining deja vu, for instance. But it explains nothing. It just actually places the answers one step behind and sort of confuses the layperson into thinking that it's been explained. And hallucinations have not been explained, and I strongly advise anybody who's interested in research into hallucinations to get hold of the last book of the late and very great Oliver Sacks, who wrote a book called Hallucinations. And in this, Sacks, who is a world-famous psychiatrist, or was a world-famous psychiatrist, says, quite frankly, we don't know what hallucinations are. And a logical extrapolation from that is that one can argue by using exactly the same logic that our perceptions of everyday reality are exactly the same thing. They are still an hallucination. For example, you and I are experiencing the world around us now. We are seeing things, we are hearing things and everything else. But if they are brain created, the brain recreates a facsimile of the external reality inside. You know, effectively, the visual world we see is the stimulation of the retina by photons, little points of energy, little points of electromagnetic energy, which stimulate the retina which are then converted into electric signals, which then are recreated or reassembled, for want of a better term, in the visual cortex of the brain, which is right at the back of the brain in the darkest possible place. The image that is transferred from the retina is postage stamp sized and inverted and bent. And yet within the brain, the brain recreates the three-dimensional surround image that you see looking out of your eyes now. So self-evidently, there's some kind of magical trick going on here. So the brain itself is, the very fact we don't see the blind spot where the optic nerve leaves the back of the eye. If we close one eye, we should have a blind section in our sight. We don't. And we don't for very good reason, because the brain fills in the missing information from nowhere. It just makes it up. So clearly, to say that it's a brain-generated hallucination gets us nowhere. So what I do in the book is I analyze exactly what we mean by hallucinations. For example, if you hallucinate, I don't know, a sort of a six-foot gorilla sitting in front of you now, sitting in front of your computer screen, there are two hallucinations going on there. There's the major hallucination, which everybody will think, oh, you're seeing a gorilla that isn't there. But there's also an hallucination of exclusion, because you cannot see the computer screen that is obscured by the body of the gorilla. In other words, there is another hallucination here, a hallucination taking out part of your visual field to accommodate the existence of the hallucination of the gorilla. Now, if you see a gorilla, it's an hallucination. If you are sitting with somebody else who happens to see the gorilla as well, our little scientist friends have an answer for that as well. They call it a folie à deux. But if two people see the same hallucination, and it has been recorded, so, you know, this is something that does happen, how can we explain that using modern science? Because if two people share an hallucination, the only way they can share the contents of their own visual field is via telepathy. So in which case, science tries to explain a mystery by creating another mystery, which also they don't accept, because, of course, modern science doesn't accept telepathy as a reality either. So there's a kind of smoke and mirrors taking place here in order for them to continue with their credibility. Now, if a group of us then see this gorilla, it's then considered to be a collective hallucination, collective hysteria. But we know, again, evidence from the past, we know that there can be circumstances where a whole hundreds, if not thousands of people can see the same hallucination. So what are we talking about here? Sort of collective telepathy over thousands of people. So clearly there is something not quite right with this. So I start then looking into the neurology and the neurochemistry of hallucinations. And there's some surprising facts that come out of this. For instance, they've done research when individuals are hallucinating, when they take dimethyltryptamine, or when people go into deep hallucinatory states, they're able to gauge what's happening in the brain. And the interesting thing is that the same parts of the brain light up when you are hallucinating seeing something as when you are really seeing something. So as far as the brain is concerned, there is absolutely no difference between hallucination and the real deal. So now we have the question is, well, if somebody has a shared hallucination, is that real? You know, the only reason we believe consensual reality is real because we share a vision of that reality with other people. You know, if you and I see an elephant walking down the street and somebody else sees an elephant, we tend to believe we've seen an elephant. Don't we? Because we do. Because you'll say, look, did you see that elephant? Yes, I did. Therefore, it must be real. The reason we believe the sky is blue is because we all see a blue sky. But of course, we then have the million-dollar question. Of course, we have no idea whether other people see the blue sky that we see, because you and I can never compare the color blue, because we never can. We can't explain the color blue except reference to other colors. And of course, this is what's called a qualia. It's exactly the same with pain. Pain doesn't exist outside of the perceiver. If there were no sensitive beings in the universe, if the Earth is the only place that sentient creatures exist, and we were all wiped out in the sun going nova or something, and that was the end of life in the universe, where has pain gone? Pain needs a perceiver in order to be. Mm-hmm. The same goes for the colour blue. The colour blue, if suddenly everybody whose eyes were who were the ones that converted that particular part of the electromagnetic spectrum to the colour blue, why wiped out? There would be no blue. There is no blue out there. There is no red out there. There is no colour out there. Colour is simply something that our brain interprets for us as being a particular part of the electromagnetic spectrum. So we have then the idea that the doors of perception are closed for us because our brain does it for us. The brain closes it. But in the book, I suggest that there are individuals who, for differing neurological reasons, the doors of perception become ajar and some of them become wide open. And that's the second section of the book.
Any, is that it, Anthony?
No, no, it's not. I'll continue if you want. I was just hoping that, you know, if you wanted to come in and make a comment.
Oh, no, no, just enjoying it.
Okay, yeah, okay, because I will
Haven't been able to get the book, waiting to read it. So, yeah, it's great to have a taste of what the book's going to be like.
But. Well, what I do is I present something I call the Huxleyan spectrum. And by the Huxleyan spectrum, I mean that there are people whose doors of perception, most neurotypicals, people like you and I guess, and most other people, and yet technically I'm not neurotypical, but the doors of perception are closed. So they exist in a world that is literally just what everybody perceives. They don't see anything extraordinary or strange. They don't have hallucinations. They don't have visions.
Common theme.
Yeah. Okay. Whereas there are some people whose doors are slightly more open. And of course, these individuals cannot share their experiences with other people because they can't share them. Now, I give an example. I'm a classic migrainer. And classic migraine is the first level of my Huxleyan spectrum. And classic migraine is not like normal migraine. Normal migraine, everyday migraine, is a migraine headache, a god-awful headache in which you feel like your head is splitting open. Classic migraine is different. Classic migraine sometimes, and for instance with myself, doesn't normally involve a headache. You can be a classic migrainer and never experience a headache, because what you experience is something called the aura. And if there are classic migrainers out there, I'm sure they'll be nodding totally with me on this, because if you have these experiences, you will be diagnosed with classic migraine. And the experiences are that sometimes, maybe once, two, three times a year, maybe even less, you will suddenly start to feel curious and strange. And you will notice that your visual field starts to break down. There seems to be what looks like a kind of a fizzy movement in your visual field. And usually this fizzy movement, which is called a scotoma, normally starts to spread. It's like jagged zigzag lines. And it expands to this half moon shape, which effectively takes out the center of your visual field. You can't see. And then you will get what's called a whiteout, and you will have this area where you literally cannot see anything. I had a migraine attack about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I was on a walk in Richmond Park with my wife, and I lose my periphery vision completely.
Jeez. Wow.
I mean completely. I mean, somebody can be standing almost in front of me, but slightly off center, and they're just not there.
How's your side view?
Yeah, your side view just goes. It's gone. And I mean gone, I don't mean that there's a kind of a blackness. It's just gone. There is nobody there. I tested this, and my wife was, you know, I was looking forward at, say, 12 o'clock, and my wife was around about 11, 2 o'clock, 2:30, in a clock face, me looking forward. She was invisible. She was not there.
I'm thinking when you said that there would be a blackness, but it's kind of like it's just chopped out.
It's chopped out. Yeah. Now, initially, you get the scotoma, which you do see. But once the scotoma takes effect, you can't see it anything. Part of your vision field just completely disappears. What I then sometimes get is tingling in the end of my fingers and tingling in my lips. But also what you get, and I've had it in the past, is strong sensations of deja vu, strong sensations that you have lived this moment before, strong sensations of familiarity of what's around you. Now, other people who have even stronger migraine than myself, classic migraine, have an effect called Charles Bonnet syndrome. And this is uncanny, and I discuss this in the book in detail. Charles Bonnet syndrome is a known syndrome, so you know I'm not making this up. This is a known syndrome and a known diagnosis. They see little people. They see little figures. There's one lady who I cite in the book who is a Swedish-American author. And the first time she had a migraine aura, she was sitting in her bedroom when she was a kid. And this little farmer walked in through the door about at 2 or 3 inches high, pulling a cow. And then these little policemen turned up in a little police car and arrested him and started haranguing him. And then they all disappeared. And Charles Bonnet syndrome, people see little people. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is because in the book I discuss a very, very curious event that took place with my mother. Around about 7 or 8 years ago, she was walking home onto the village that she lives on in Wirral on Merseyside near Liverpool. And she was with my aunt, and my aunt stopped to tie her shoelace. And as my mother did so, now the background to this is my mother is partially sighted. She lost one of her eyes through malignant melanoma a few years previous to that. So she's partially sighted in one eye. She has this false eye that looks real. It's really quite strange. And it moves, you know, so you cannot tell. And in the other eye, she was developing cataracts. So she was partially sighted. As she looks at my aunt, she sees something in the sky above one of the local factories. And she described it as being a disc that seemed to be made of smoke. And the smoke seemed to swirl around. And then the disc flew off at super speed towards North Wales. Now, my mother doesn't know anything about UFOs and has never mentioned UFOs to me. She's never read a book on UFOs, never shown any interest in it. But what she was describing there was a classic UFO. Now, I know that this she saw a classic UFO, and I also know that she saw a real UFO because on Facebook, and somebody can check this up, there's a Facebook friend of mine who, when I posted this about 8 or 9 months ago, she posted straight away to say that she had been in that location about 2 or 3 miles away from where my mother was on that day, and she saw the same object. Not only her, but two other people, including a taxi driver. So there's this real object, shoots off into the distance, and that's it. 2 or 3 days later, one morning, my mother rings me. She's a widow, lives on her own. She's in a state of hysteria. She woke up in the middle of the night, and she noticed her bedroom door was open. And then she saw, to her absolute horror, a group of spindly fingers come round the door. And this creature popped its head round the door. And this is how she described it. It had huge black eyes. It had a pointed chin, a slit for a mouth, and two little holes for a nose. It saw her, blinked, and dodged its head behind again. She saw a classic grey. You know, this is the archetypal grey, the grey that's on the cover of Whitley Strieber's book, Communion.
Yeah, Communion. Yeah.
The reason I mention that is Whitley Strieber has written the foreword for this book.
That's right, that's correct, yes, yeah.
Because Strieber is fascinated by my hypothesis to such an extent he believes my hypothesis has probably explained his experiences. Okay, it's an aside which we can come back to later.
Yeah, Whitley's a great, great man, yeah.
Oh, totally, and his experiences are bizarre in the extreme. But here is my mother, who's never would never know what these creatures are or what they even look like, and she sees this. She phones me up and she's hysterical. I talk her down and I say, don't worry about it. I immediately thought, this is interesting. And a few months later, she started to claim that she was seeing little children in the house. She then said that there was an old gentleman that used to smile at her in her kitchen. And she said, oh, he's not nasty or anything, but he just smiles at me and nods. I started to get concerned here, because my mother was a classic migrainer. Mm. But I think these things she was saying she was seeing was more intense. And I took her off to see a specialist, or I took her off to see a doctor. And the doctor clearly did not have a clue as to what was happening. So I pointed out to the doctor, I said, I think my mother is developing dementia. I think she's developing Alzheimer's. And the reason I think she's developing Alzheimer's is she is experiencing Charles Bonnet syndrome, the syndrome I was talking about before, because Charles Bonnet syndrome is also associated with another area of my Huxleyan spectrum, and that is Alzheimer's. People who have Alzheimer's, their reality back in the way in which they perceive reality, the way in which the brain takes out information starts to malfunction. The breakdown of the microtubules within the brain, the way in which the amyloid plaques develop within the brain, because in the book I give a full description of exactly what takes place when somebody has Alzheimer's.
Yeah, I've seen it firsthand as well, Anthony, with my grandmothers and stuff. Yeah, I've actually looked into the face of that. Not knowing you, not knowing your own family members, just looking straight through you. It's an incredible experience to see a loved one that you've known your whole life, like a grandparent, just look through you with these eyes like jelly, you know?
I know. And on top of that, it is as if the receiver, which is the brain, because the central argument I use in the book is the brain is a receiver. So therefore, if there is a breakdown of the ability of the brain to receive messages from the field of consciousness, what will happen is, like a radio malfunctioning, the person won't be able to get through anymore. The person is not there anymore because, of course, the person, rather similar or analogous to, you have a radio and you would assume that when you hear an orchestra playing or a news broadcast on your radio, if you didn't know any better, you'd assume that the radio studio and the broadcasters are inside the radio. This is what we confuse consciousness. We assume because it seems that consciousness is in the brain because we speak through our mouths, and therefore, and if we do things to the brain, things go wrong in terms of consciousness and our personality. But if you take the bits and pieces out the back of a radio, the signal doesn't come through, or the signal becomes garbled. And it's exactly the same that's happening with Alzheimer's. What is happening is the signal is being garbled. And in the book, I do the science of this because one of the areas of the brain that gets particularly damaged by the amyloid plaques within Alzheimer's disease and within dementia are the microtubules, which are little structures of tubulin that make up the neurons of the brain. And they start to fall apart. They start to get destroyed. Now, there's a researcher called Stuart Hammerhoff at the University of Arizona, who, with a British mathematician called Roger Penrose, has come up with something he calls orchestrated objective reduction, ORC-OR. And this is a theory that suggests that the brain is a receiver and the brain works on quantum physics lines. And they argue that the microtubules in the brain are the receivers of information, and that they create little holographic images, which is then projected into the outside world, which is what we perceive as external reality.
That's incredible.
Okay. Now, with Alzheimer's, that signals the facility for the microtubules to actually take in the signal, which I argue is from the zero point field, the information field. Because there is growing evidence now that the universe we perceive is digital. It's information. At its baseline, reality is not made of solid anythings. It's made of information. And again, I would strongly suggest you and the listeners out there check out a book written by a professor of physics by the name of Vlatko Vedrel, who is based at the University of Singapore. And he's written a book on the universe as digital information. And his argument is overpowering. Now, on top of this, they are starting a lot of researchers at the Perimeter Institute in the States, and a lot of scientists over there are now looking for the evidence of the digitization of reality as we see it. Without going into the complexity, the final chapter of the book, I discuss in detail how the digitization works. And indeed, myself and Irvin Laszlo touch upon this in the last chapter in The Immortal Mind as well. That it's to do with black holes, and it's to do with the loss of information within black holes. It's very complex, but we try to get it across as straightforward as we can.
When you say digital, I keep thinking numbers and computers and stuff like that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it's exactly what it is.
It's just organic type?
It's an organic, well, it's not even an organic computer. It's even more complex than that. It's too detailed here to go into, but it's to do with the edge of the universe as we know it is actually projecting in information from things that are tiny little projectors the size of the Planck length.
Like hologram type type?
It's hologram. Mm. It's a hologram. Yeah. The whole of what we perceive is holographic in its nature. And again, the Scientific American magazine around about 4 or 5 years ago had a front cover, and it said, "Are we in a hologram?"
That's right.
Growing evidence that we're in a hologram. So this is all tied in with the holographic theory. But it's more than that. It suggests that this is a simulation. And the simulation, we perceive the simulation. So the information in the that builds the simulation is drawn up by the brain, or drawn up by things in the brain to create the visual world and the visual world we live in. So effectively, I argue in the book that we are existing within our own three-dimensional virtual reality game. And the virtual reality game is the game of our lives. So, you know, in the first book, I said we were existing in a rerun of our lives created by our brains from our memories.
That's right.
It's much more complex now. I now suggest that we live in a groundhog life, which is a virtual reality computer game that we are embedded within, which has programmed within it a rendering of the outcome of every possible decision we could possibly make.
It's almost like the real us, the energy us, the soul us, is in some other place, projecting what us now, playing this game. Like a game of life to learn. I would say, because it sounds almost as well like, I would ask you with your episodes that you had with the migraine. After you have those attacks, do you feel like you have moments of where you want to, write material, or do you feel like maybe when that happens to you, you're being almost downloaded with information? It seems
funnily enough, that
could be happening as well.
It could, because funnily enough, a lot of writers
creativity. You get feel the same creativity.
Way. I read my books afterwards, and sometimes I'll read a section, oh my god, where did that come from? I don't even remember writing that. When you're in a writing fugue, you flow, and the words just come out and the ideas just come out. People who know me personally know that I have a very peculiar brain, in that I don't have infinite recall, but I have a very, very powerful recall mechanism whereby I can know facts that I don't even remember reading about, and I know I'm right. And people who have done quizzes with me or have seen me talk or lecture know this, that I seem to have all the facts and figures at my fingertips. But these aren't me thinking, when have I dealt with that? And then I think into my brain and I try to go to my memories and remember. It's instantaneously there. I don't have to think about the information. It's just there. And I believe that's because, again, there's an informational field out there and we attune into it. You know, it's the Akashic record, as the old mystics have had, the Akashic field, as Irvin Laszlo calls it. And the Akashic field is technically the zero-point field. And this is the informational field that has the digital information encoded within it. Now, I said about migraine. I also suggest that people who have temporal lobe epilepsy, the doors of perception are even wider. And I have sections in my book about temporal lobe epilepsy. There's a few people I've interviewed who have TLE, and I discuss that. I then move into schizophrenia. Now, all that's migraine, temporal lobe epilepsy and schizophrenia can all be linked. There are areas of migraine, classic migraine, that are epileptic in the makeup. It's called alepsinogenic migraine. So there's an overlap between migraine and temporal lobe epilepsy. And people who have temporal lobe epilepsy have even more powerful hallucinations in the aura state.
I've seen that firsthand, Anthony,
really?
With a man who had at least 4 or 5 split personalities, and I've seen it right in front of me. I've seen the cowardly, wimpy voice come out, a voice screaming at that one. The staring, the giggling, it was a person that I used to work with. It was amazing, just looking straight through you, then giggling, and just all these personalities coming out. It's an amazing thing to see.
A lot of people don't understand. He was epileptic. Was he temporal lobe epileptic as well?
I don't know. He was on very powerful drugs, which seems to be making it worse. I know that much, but I'm not sure about his condition. I didn't really know him. He was a work person, and eventually he left, but he had these multiple personalities. It was all day, just shifting.
What I believe is happening here, I touch upon it in the book The Daemon, but the Uber theory that I'm building up now suggests a more broader explanation for this. In my book, The Infinite Mindfield, which is my second to last book, which was very much the prequel to this one, I suggest that that we are all one consciousness experiencing itself subjectively. So within the program, we are individuals, but outside of the program, we are one individual consciousness, collective consciousness, God, for want of a better word. But the word God just has certain connotations, and I'm not saying God, but the collective everything that is all of us.
So it's like one consciousness just scattered into sand.
Correct. One consciousness experiencing itself subjectively, as Bill Hicks said in one of his famous monologues.
Yes.
And I have contributed a chapter to a book that comes out in January on the subject of pandeism. And pandeism is the idea that everything is just one, it's unitary, which is, of course, exactly what the Buddhists argue. It's what the Hindus argue. It's something that the mystics have argued for years. You find the God within. Entheogenic substances, DMT and such like, actually entheogenic actually means, you know, the God within. It's finding the God within yourself. Now, if this is the case, it means if we're one single consciousness, we're also multiple consciousnesses. And certain fractured consciousnesses can actually pick up other parts of the consciousness field. And these consciousnesses can come in to that conscious being and cause all kinds of trouble.
It's like radio frequencies, isn't it?
Picking up wrong radio people and people coming in. Now, this could explain mediumship. This, as I said, could explain dissociative personality, which is the technical term for multiple personality syndrome. It could explain possession. It could explain so many things. It could explain foreign language syndrome. It's because the tuning is getting blurred. And because the doors are open, you can get what's called drop-ins. And in mediumship, there's something called drop-ins where people suddenly start talking as somebody else and communicating. Now, if the program is also outside of time, it means that there is a timeless place where the program exists and the information field exists. So in other words, what happened 50 years ago or 50,000 years ago is still now as far as the program is concerned. So this is why we could have multiple lives. This is why we could remember living in ancient Egypt, or people could remember living in ancient Rome. It's because they're tuning into the field. And the field, they pick up information from the field, like tuning a radio. And you suddenly find the radio station of somebody who lived in Rome, who is concurrent now. Because time, in my book, The Labyrinth of Time, I discuss this as well. That time, have you seen the movie, Interstellar
at all? Oh, Matthew McConaughey.
Yes.
Yes, I have.
Yeah, and there's one section in there called the Tesseract sequence where he is outside of time and space and he's looking in and he can see his daughter's life panned out in different ways because he's seeing the whole of her life from the fifth dimension, which is outside of space and time. And if you were outside of space and time, somebody's life would just be a permanent now. So their birth and death would be the same moment and every moment in between. So they'd look like a long snake-like creature. And the director of the film tried very hard to get over that idea of the Tesseract, the idea that you can see all time from one location. And in fact, my new book that I'm researching now, J.B. Priestley, the British author, many of his time plays discussed this idea of time outside time, his time and the Conways play, his I Have Been Here Before play. They all deal with the circularity of time. Very, very great author. I think he really needs a re-looking at, particularly, you know. So we have these snapshots, but I also believe that I can explain UFOs because I believe that if there are other entities out there, you know, we're being very chauvinistic if we think that we are the only sentient species in the universe.
Of course.
So the single consciousness could involve other alien consciousnesses.
Yes.
That could also manifest within us and manifest within our worldview. So suddenly now, and these things could be hostile, they could not be hostile. So my next book, my sequel to this book is going to be called Through the Doors of Perception. And I'm going to be explaining UFO phenomena. I'm going to be explaining abduction phenomena. I'm going to be trying to explain the fairy folk, how we see alien creatures out there, and how they've been with us since the beginning of time. And they are part of the overall Uber universe that we exist within. Because this is now starting to make us throw open the doors of perception and realize we're in a far greater, far more incredible universe than we can ever imagine. And our science has explained a very tiny part of that.
Yeah. And it could be hyperdimensional, interdimensional entities as well.
Yeah, totally. So what I believe is that our science, we can explain the materialist reductionist world that we exist within here, certain elements of it. But we have so many clues to the greater universe, the universe outside of the things that we can perceive. And I think this is the next paradigm change. And I genuinely believe, and I know this sounds vain, but it's not meant to be, is that I'm the only writer on the planet that's doing this. There are people writing about UFOs. There are people writing about out-of-the-body experiences, lucid dreaming, remote viewing. There are people writing about spirit possession. There are people writing about quantum physics. There are people writing about, I don't know, dozens of things.
But
I'm the only one. And this is why I don't think why I'm not as famous as my work suggests I should be. And this is because everybody's just getting a little bit of what Anthony Peake is writing about. But few people are actually looking at the overall work. And when they look at that, and when they seriously do, it's a wow, because the people who really appreciate my work are the real scientists, the quantum physicists, the neurologists. I speak to neurologists, and the neurologists I'm in contact with are absolutely staggered about the stuff I write.
That's a great thing. Because most scientists are more skeptic than they are scientists, and that's a terrible attitude to have. It's like being an atheist, I feel. A lot of these scientists now, they're more skeptical, and they criticize everything without even it being presented to them, you know?
A certain group do. The eliminative materialists. But you have now, for instance, there's more and more quantum physicists throughout history
who have changed.
Yeah. Now, I give an example of this, like Wolfgang Pauli, Pauli's exclusion principle. Because the other thing that we haven't touched upon is quantum physics. And people who criticize my work seem to be in this naive opinion that I'm some kind of person that's just read sort of some easy primer on quantum physics. And I've picked up certain bits, like a lot of New Age writers do. And I've used that in my writing. These are people that haven't read my work. People who read my work know that however deep they want to go into the quantum physics model, I can go down there with them. You know, I understand Pauli's exclusion principle. I understand Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. I know why certain things are in quantum physics the way they are. You know, I can go down to the level that they want to go to, and I can debate to that level.
You nailed it.
But people like Wolfgang Pauli, for instance, towards the end of his life, he became fascinated with synchronicity. But this is the guy that invented Pauli exclusion principle. Schrödinger wrote a book towards the end of his life called What is Life? And Schrödinger started to apply quantum physics to consciousness, quantum physics to the way we perceive the world. Because these are serious guys who are looking for answers. My argument is a lot of the present scientists are sadly looking after their own tenure. Mm. They cannot be seen to be discussing things with me. And one guy actually said that to me. He said, privately, I can agree with you totally. I can never, ever be seen to be agreeing with you in any way whatsoever publicly, because my credibility will be eroded. I will lose my tenure at university if I'm even seen discussing these issues. For instance, an example of this, there's a guy called Brian Josephson, who is a Cambridge physicist, quantum physicist. Josephson is one of the few British living Nobel Prize winners in physics. Okay, he came up with something called the Josephson Junction. Believe it or not, because he's interested in ESP and interested in the kind of things we're interested in, There was a few years ago, there was an edition of stamps that were coming out with British Nobel Prize winners on the stamps. Do you know they vetoed putting Josephson on the stamp because he was interested in ESP?
That's right.
That is outrageous. That is the Inquisition. That is just so wrong, it's untrue.
It's happening everywhere.
Yeah. And we need to change that. And the way we change it, going back to the start of the interview, is we change this by presenting the evidence to the naysayers that they cannot deny. Do the physics. Do the neurology. Do the neurochemistry. You know, I do the neurochemistry. I discuss the glial cells in the brain. I discuss how certain neurotransmitters work. I discuss the evidence that dimethyltryptamine is created in the pineal gland. I don't say it. I give my readers the papers. There's been work done by a lady called Jimo Bojijin at the University of Michigan, where they have discovered in the brains of live rats DMT, which suggests that the DMT is created by the pineal gland. And it's not at all surprising because DMT is chemically very, very similar to one of the substances that is created by the pineal gland, melatonin.
Right. Yep.
So here we have evidence that cannot just be dismissed. So what they do with me is they ignore me. I get ignored. I don't get engaged with. I get ignored.
Yeah, that's their ultimate.
They would prefer to pretend I didn't exist.
That's right. Yeah.
And they will continue going for the woo-woo writers that are easy targets. You know, you can have goes at these people that say, oh, you know, I get out my body and I can see things, or I talk to dead people, or I'm channeling from the planet Tharg. They're easy targets. They never target me, but in a very, very subtle way. They target me by just trying to erode my credibility.
Well, they won't debate you, will they?
Oh, no. They've on two or three occasions, they've backed down. There's been debates set up, and they won't turn up. They
won't
debate with me.
No, they won't. They will never do it.
No, because they are scared. I mean, for instance, the Liverpool University Rationalist Society invited me to speak a few years ago, and they backed out 3 days before. They totally backed out. They checked me out and they thought, oh, we've got some kind of woo-woo nutter here. We'll have a bit of fun. And then they checked me out and realized, oh, shit. Do we really know as much physics as this guy does? Do we really know as much neurology? And when they see me perform and can see my ability to actually throw out information, it's then, oh, shit, he could make us look very stupid.
Well, these are the people that have heard about you but know nothing about your work. Make that judgment.
I'll give a classic example of this. If you Google me, the second thing you will get after my website is a virtually libelous section on me in something called Rational Wiki. Okay? That is incorrect. The statements on there are incorrect.
Skeptics.
But I can't even take it down. Whereas with normal Wiki, you can actually amend it and everything else. Rational Wiki, you can't. So that thing stands up there and there is bugger all I can do about it. And these are my people who have not read my books. One person once said to me, I don't need to read your books to know you're a woo-woo. Now, that isn't science. That's prejudice.
Okay, yeah, I'm seeing that. Yeah, yeah. I think you're dealing with the Skeptic Society, Anthony. We're dealing with them in Australia. It comes on many issues, not just what you're doing, but medical issues, all sorts of issues, the same people in there. There seems to be thousands of these trolls in there. They seem to be all tied up with these science skeptics.
But they are. But the reason is because they're frustrated, because let's face it, there is an awful lot of nonsense out there. Self-evident, ridiculous nonsense where people will believe the most arrant crap and then put it up on Facebook and everything else. And it annoys the hell out of me because I am a skeptic. You know, I have great sympathies with skeptics. And it's those idiots that are doing the nonsense that erode the serious work that people like myself are trying
to do. That's right. Well, you have to be a skeptic as well. You know, of course you do in your life to look and judge things,
But what it then does is it gives them the opportunity to deflect from what I'm doing and focus in on the nonsense, because that's an easy target. And they, as I say, they can then happily ignore me. They can just shoot me down with no actual criticism. If you actually read this particular thing on the web, it's an ad hominem attack. It turns around and says, Anthony Peake has no scientific qualifications. Agreed, I don't, but I have a social science qualification. I've studied at postgraduate level. I know my statistics. But the other thing that is most important is, I defy anybody to be qualified in all subjects that I write about. You can't be a quantum physicist and a neurophysicist and a historian and a sociologist and a psychologist and somebody who's aware of the things I'm aware of, the broad spectrum that I approach. And it's only because of the broad spectrum of my level of inquiry that I'm able to pull these things together. You couldn't have PhDs in all the areas I discuss. But, and this is the important point, I can engage with people who have got PhDs in these subjects. And believe me, without exception, they're all absolutely staggered at the things I say.
I think, you know, I think as well, Anthony, for my personal, for me personally, you know, reading your books and your material, it strikes you at a heart level. And, you know, I could wash all that off the table, the academic stuff, studying this, studying that, all of that, and honestly tell you that I read your books and it strikes me at a very deep level. And it's just, I can't get enough of the information. It's almost like a lot of the information I already know. Maybe I've forgotten it. I think maybe some of these people, they're just not ready for the shift, and they're just not on board with us, and they're not ready to go ahead with the change, you know?
Well, the thing is, I'm just an ordinary guy.
People read your books and it hits them in a certain way. And yeah, I think that's what's
because I write from the ordinary guy's point of view, and because, or the ordinary person's point of view, because I write with the wonderment that I find about the world around me. And the fact that I've always asked questions since childhood, and I always will continue to ask questions. And these are the important issues going forward. And there are a group of us that are moving forward. And there is a turning. I can sense a turning with a lot of people now.
Oh, it's already begun.
The arguments putting together, people are starting to now think, you know, there's something in this. Now, the difference is, you see, I don't have any axe to grind. I don't have a belief system. I'm not trying to prove anything, whereas lots of writers in our field want to prove UFOs exist, want to prove that out-of-body experiences exist. I've never wanted to do that. I want to understand why they are, what they mean, what they signify for the human condition. So my approach, if somebody comes along and disproves completely a lot of what I do, that's fine. I'll just write another book with these new ideas that have come up because this person has disproved. And I continually say to people, please, 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 if what I say is wrong, or something I say is wrong, or I've got the wrong end of the stick on something, just tell me. I'll change it. I will change my point of view, because that, to me, is the most important thing. To have an open mind with new information, but don't have an open mind so much that your brain falls out.
That's something you just don't hear nowadays, especially with you know, people at such a high level like yourself, willing to take judgment. And if you're wrong, you're wrong. You're willing to move forward and keep learning, you know. You're not showing any stubborn aspects here. You're just, you don't hear that much with people, so.
Well, this is the reason being that whenever you have a paradigm change in science, there will be those who are so wedded into the previous paradigm structure
that
they will
change.
Fight tooth and nail. You know, as they say, science doesn't change by inventions or research. It changes through funerals. As the old god die away, the new people come in with the new ideas. And we're in a very similar position now to the way in which Western science was about 120 years ago. You know, 120 years ago, they had black body radiation that they couldn't explain. They couldn't explain the spectral lines of hydrogen. They couldn't explain the photoelectric effect. And in 1900, Max Planck came along. In December of 1900 in Berlin, Max Planck read out a paper explaining how the ultraviolet catastrophe could be avoided. But in doing so, he brought in quantum physics and the idea of quanta, that energy comes in little packets, which was completely unbelievable. And then in 1905, Einstein comes along with his fantastic year where he wrote his papers, and he showed that what was happening in the electromagnetic effect, and that light was made of tiny point particles, which was subsequently called photons. But then we bring out what's called wave-particle duality. Is light a wave or is it a particle? We have non-locality. you know, proven non-locality. The most incredible experiment that has ever taken place in the last century took place in Paris in 1981 by a guy called Dalibard and Aspe. This experiment proved non-locality. It should have been headlines around the world. It was ignored.
Yeah.
And it was ignored. Scientists know about it. They all do. Even the most radical negative scientists cannot avoid the fact of the Aspe experiment. They also cannot avoid the results that a guy called Anton Zeilinger at the University of Vienna is getting now in terms of subatomic particles. You know, subatomic world is impossible. We have dark energy. We have dark matter. 94% of the universe is missing. Come on. Scientists readily admit we do not know what happens at the inside of a black hole. We have no idea. We don't even know how gravity works. They pretend they do, but they don't.
They say the science is settled.
They do. And of course they said science was settled in 1894. You know, there was these glib statements made then, you know, that we only need to do calculations to a number of decimal points and then we will know everything. And of course they didn't. They didn't have a clue. They were just so it's called hubris. Pride before a fall. And we have scientists now doing the same. You know, standing up there and saying, oh, you know, we've got it all sussed. We have our understanding of particle physics now. You know, we have a model that can explain virtually everything in quantum physics. Well, no, it doesn't, actually. And anybody that reads in any kind of depth will know that it doesn't explain. It's like a Heath Robinson device. They've come up with all these theories upon theories upon theories to explain the observed phenomena. But the theories don't actually... they inadequately explain the phenomena. They should be going back to first basics to understand how is it two particles can communicate instantaneously. The reason two particles can instantaneously communicate, therefore violating Einstein's limit of the speed of light and therefore communication, is that at a deeper level of reality, they're the same bloody particle. So you are not looking at two particles, you're looking at one particle. And again, they should read the work of one of the greatest scientists of the last century, David Bohm. And David Bohm came up with something called the implicate and explicate orders. This is the science of the future. And this is the science that we are pushing forward now. And there are people like Vletko Vedrell, and there are other scientists who are coming forward now. The younger guys are willing to accept that by ignoring the evidence of consciousness, by ignoring certain elements of their own science, we are missing a trick. We are missing the explanations that are actually out there.
That's right. And I can't believe in schools and university and science lessons what people have been taught. And one thing that always gets me is they're saying the human genome contains around 20,000 genes. That is that, you know, it's stretches of DNA that encode proteins. But they're saying these genes account for only 1.2%, as we know, of the total genome. And they're saying 98.8% is known as non-coding DNA, which our scientists call junk. So they're
junk.
Saying 98.8% of the human DNA is garbage. That's what they're telling us.
Yep.
And this is something that always staggered me. Is this in your mind, is this because they simply don't understand? And I'm wondering what is encoded in this DNA that they're calling junk. And I'm wondering as well if they do know what's in it and if it points to the stars, if it points
could be.
You know,
well,
to something
else.
But I'm wondering also with consciousness if this has a connection here with what you're writing about in our consciousness, which it's so amazing because we now put information into the cloud. And it seems that that's what our consciousness is. You know, it's like it's not part of our brains. It's a field. And I'm wondering if our genes, our DNA, is connected here and there.
Well, they're obviously lying
about this. You know, it's terrible.
Well, Francis Crick himself came up with the panspermia idea. The DNA actually came from somewhere else, because as he argued, the way DNA is, if the way it is evolved, it couldn't have evolved here. And he used the analogy. Yeah, it's alien. And he used the analogy, it's like a whirlwind going into a junk shop, whirling round and creating a jumbo jet. It clearly needed far longer in time to evolve the way it is evolved. And, you know, who created DNA? It was DNA created in some way. the actual junk DNA is a fascinating subject, as is the glial cells in the brain. You know the statement that people turn around and say you only ever use 15% of your brain. What they're actually meaning is 15% of our brain is made up of neurons. Neurons that communicate electrically using neurochemicals. The vast majority of brain cells are glial cells. Glial is German for glue. That's what they believe they're there to do, just glue the neurons together. But there's been recent research shown that glial cells work non-locally. They can communicate instantaneously. They can communicate non-locally, which means they're using quantum physics to communicate non-locality, which explains certain problems with the human brain, such as something called the binding problem. Why is it that we have a feeling of simultaneity? If I look out the window now and I see a red bouncing ball bouncing down the street, different parts of my brain are processing different things. One part of my brain is processing the red, another part is processing the bounce, another part is processing other things. We have the simultaneous feeling of a ball bouncing down the street. If you ever want to embarrass a neurologist, just ask him about the binding problem. They don't know. They haven't got a clue. They don't know why it works. Just like they don't understand how the placebo works. It's the same problem. It's because they are jumping to conclusions and they are rigidly within a particular worldview and a particular paradigm. These things will change. I think that junk DNA, one of my publishers approached me 2 years ago and said it'd be really good if you could write a book on junk DNA.
I think
I think I'm planning to, because I'm going to plan the new book is going to have a section on junk DNA and an expanded section on glial cells, because I think these two paths, because in my book, The Infinite Mind Field, I suggest that DNA is synonymous with the snakes that are seen when people take ayahuasca and they take DMT.
That's right.
I think that there's a linkage here, and I think it's our own DNA communicating with us.
Nature because, comes alive.
Yeah, and we are DNA. We are DNA. We are carriers for DNA. You know, the blind watchmaker, Richard Dawkins of all people, you know, argued that effectively, you know, we are slaves to our DNA.
Why is it, do you think, that they decided to say that 98.8% of our DNA is junk? And then the other 1.2% isn't. What made them come to this conclusion, do you think? I mean,
I wish I knew.
Incredible. I mean, who came up with that 98.8? Why are they saying that?
Well, on top of
this, we're being hoodwinked.
Well, on top of this, you know, we know that nature, the law of parsimony, we know that nature does not have things it doesn't need. Nature would not create a universe that's 94% missing. It wouldn't create a brain that 85% of it is cells that don't do anything. It wouldn't create DNA that the vast majority of the DNA is supposedly junk. It just doesn't do that. It does it in the most sensible way.
Perfect, man.
And of course, the billion-dollar question is, if DMT is created in the brain, it means that DMT has been evolved to be in the brain, which means it's actually part of, again, the genome. It's part of us. And is this, again...
And same with cannabinoids.
Yes, exactly the same.
We have receptors in our bodies.
Yeah, we have receptors. For instance, the TARs, the trace associated amine receptors in the brain, and the sigma 1 and sigma 2 receptors, they all work with things like DMT. So
they fit like a glove.
Yes. So if DMT is a neurotransmitter, which it seems to be, it means it's evolved. Now I think it's part of the evolving of the human race. I think we are starting to become the term post-human is bandied around. Ray Kurzweil and people like that. Post-humanism is the next stage where we're going to move to being with living within a simulation. But we've already moved. It's just we don't know. I'm aware of time.
That's right.
I think we've just scratched the surface. No, it's just my wife has just turned up for lunch.
That's right, yeah. I mean, you wouldn't want to have a couple of beers in a pub with me, Anthony. You'd never get out. You'd be like, those bloody Australians.
This is why... When guys like you and I get together and people that I liaise with, we are really pushing the edge because we are thinking new ideas. We're thinking, I hate the term thinking out of the box, but we are trying to understand the mystery of what is. Why?
That's what I'm doing, Anthony. I'm not attached to any one thing, you know, I'm just trying to find out stuff.
And that's the difference between me and a lot of writers. I'm asking why. Other writers are trying to find answers to who is doing it. You see what I mean? You know, that's the difference. I'm I'm just amazed at the evidence that there is out there. But the evidence just tells me that there is something magical going on.
That's right. Do you feel like, Anthony, you're here to learn?
Yep.
You know, I just feel like I'm here to learn, and exactly what you said. You know, I got sucked into that conspiracy stuff and people running the earth, but I'm feeling like exactly what you said, that it's this game of life, and we're here learning, and we can control it with our minds and how we perceive
and see
things.
And if we are only one consciousness experiencing itself subjectively, we are all experiencing it together.
Exactly.
We're all part of this incredible game. Who's running the game? That is the billion-dollar question. But a lot of serious scientists, and I mean serious scientists here, argue it's the simulation argument is it's our own people in the future. And again, this is not the guy down the pub. This is people like Nick Bostrom and various other researchers.
It's our true spiritual selves?
Yeah, in effect, it could be. Or our evolved selves, I don't know.
Our evolved selves, yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, Adams, great talking to you.
Yeah, I didn't even get to go into nightmares with you. Maybe another time.
Let's do it again. You know, you can do another half an hour if you want later in the week or whatever.
I had direct experiences with night terrors growing up and even speaking in other languages and hallucinations, visions, things in the room, dragged off my bed, all sorts of stuff. I've talked a little bit about it, but my wife's heard me talking another language and she said it's not gibberish. You know, sitting up in the bed, and I wanted to go. I've heard you go into that a little bit, and I suffered terribly when I was young, into my teenage years, even into my 20s, just horrific nightmares. It was.
Maybe we can just have a Skype chat between ourselves about it?
Yeah, it's probably something you haven't heard much before. It's quite unique.
No, I have heard a lot of it.
This is pretty extreme stuff. Yeah, yeah. How real it seems, but you know that's okay. I mean, I don't want so much. You to give me advice, but I wanted to talk to you about it because I've heard you.
I'd love to talk to you about it.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard you in some other interviews going into that and sleep paralysis and these things. Yep. It seems that something's happening in my sleep for sure, but. Maybe when we go to sleep, that's more real than this. I don't know, but
I think it is.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks for speaking. I've got a billion questions for you, but you know, tonight was all about promoting your new book, and I can't wait to get into it. When does the actual book get released? What is there different dates for the US and UK or
at the end of this week for the UK and the USA?
Okay, because I heard the 13th.
13th seems to be wrong to me. I mean, it's today, but the book is out. I mean, I've got copies of it and has quite a few people have got advanced copies. So it is already out there.
Can people get a signed copy and order it?
If you want a signed copy, please just order directly off my website. If you want signed copies, you can get it in bookshops, you can get it on Kindle, you can get it anywhere. But if you want a signed copy, just go onto my website, antonypeak.com. And I'll send a signed copy. I have copies here.
Opening the Doors of Perception, The Key to Cosmic Awareness, Anthony Peake, 2016. Kindle price is $7 for me here, and paperback is $14.67. So I'll get it on the Kindle as soon as it comes out. It's great you offer it on that as well for us Kindle holders.
My publishers do.
Yeah, it's good for me. I can't have books just at the moment, and I can get it immediately, so it really makes a difference. But that's going to be great. Thanks for talking with me today, Anthony, and hopefully we can have a chat soon.
Look forward to it, Adam. Well. It's been good.
Good luck on the book, and great work, my friend. Thanks for talking
with me. Thank you. Great show. Buddy. Okay, see ya. Bye.
Thanks to Anthony Peake. I had like a billion questions to ask Anthony, as you do, but just wanted to for him to go over his new book, and it was a great chatting with him, so catch up next time. Thanks to Anthony. Get that book.